there. I'm Andy Trescott, Program Officer with the Delaware Division of the Arts, and your host today. My guest is Greg Hammond, a 2022 Delaware Division of the Arts Emerging Individual Artist Fellow in the field of fiction literature. Greg, welcome to the Delaware State of the Arts. Greg, can you tell us a little bit about how you got started with your writing?
Well, I guess early childhood always, was a reader. I was a kid that grew up reading books. My mother was a big advocate. And so some of my earliest heroes, other than athletes and baseball stars and basketball stars, were actually writers. And so I was a kid that read a lot of books and just, couldn't find enough to read. I grew up in at one point in Chester, and we lived near Deshaun Park, and the Deshaun Library was right there. And after I would go play basketball, I would go in the summer to cool off into the Deshaun Library when it was open, and read books until I was tired and ready to go home. But also growing up in media in Wallingford, there was the libraries there that I would go to. So my mother introduced us to books and reading very early. That was something that was very important to our family.
One might say, well, I'm a huge reader, but I don't necessarily have the inkling to write because I read a lot. And so I wonder if you could share a little bit about what bridged that gap for you from being an avid reader to then saying, I want to start writing a book myself.
That's a good question. I started out, I used to love reading poetry. So I started writing poetry, started trying to craft poetry, trying to learn how to craft poetry. I always wanted to write a novel, but was really quite intimidated at the whole idea of it. And secondly, I just never had any clue of how to begin, where to start, and what would I write about. And although I loved reading novels, and then all of the writers that I had read about, Langston Hughes, and they were such well-traveled people. So they had something to write about, experiences to write about. And I had nowhere that I was had experiences to write about, but a lot of, authors, they tell you, you write about what you know. But I just didn't think what I knew was of any interest to anybody.
When did you start writing? What did you find it was pretty later in life? Or did you find yourself writing, mini novels as a child?
Well, actually, it's very funny. In the fifth grade, I wrote, we had to do a book report. And my book report, we had to read a book and fifth grade in Summit Elementary School in Mrs. Kelly's fifth grade class. And we had to do a book report on, and my book was Ethan Allen and the Green Mountain Boys. So, and we had to stand in front of the class and of course, give a report or I guess of what the book was like and why we liked it, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I decided to write a play. And I wrote out the play, the report in the form of a play, built a stage, built little puppets or made little puppets for it. And I gave my first book report, my first oral book report as a staged play in front of the whole class on Ethan Allen and the Green Mountain Boys. And the teacher and everyone thought it was so creative and that I was a natural writer. And then from then on, I just continued to write on the side. And I studied under a number of people. I went to Columbia University and then University of Penn and studied poetry under Daniel Hoffman and read John Edgar Wideman and a number of other writers that were, great teachers at those universities. I still was not very confident about my ability. I studied with Sonia Sanchez at Temple University at one point, but I still wasn't confident about my ability. And so I would always just do it, on the side. thinking that, oh, maybe, you know, and just kept working at it. I went to law school at Georgetown University, and then, you know, entered a career as a healthcare executive. But on the side, I would just keep writing and keep writing, and wrote my first novel, which was a historical thriller. Just, you know, from there on, ended up traveling and got a job working as a consultant, a political consultant, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And that became the basis of the current book called Blue Money that I completed and was the recipient of the fellowship.
If I may, for just a moment here, I want to share that your family, your paternal family, has been in the region for over 300 years. They were free African Americans, teachers, professors, ministers, and lawyers who lived nearby in Glen Mills, PA, since 1785. And I wonder how that just level of history and level of foundation within the local area has had an influence in your writing.
I don't know how much of a sense, but it certainly gave me a sense of place. Like, this is my community. This is where I'm from. I mean, Delaware, also my grandfather and great-grandfather were from Delaware. Several of my relatives, I mean, the family court building is named after a cousin of mine, Leonard Williams, who also graduated from Georgetown, who was a judge. The AUMP conference, which grew into the out of Juneteenth, and the celebration that they have in downtown Wilmington. You know, most of the people who were the bishops of the AUMP conference were my great grandfathers or someone of Hammond blood. Who they were there from the early, you know, 1700s, and they were free African Americans who were involved in not only the church, the politics, but also in working with the Underground Railroad for free slaves, or for slaves that were fleeing the South, coming north towards freedom. So I guess in a way it gave me a sense of pride about my family and its place in the mosaic that we call America, and a sense of belonging where a number of people, even those who are European, didn't get here until the turn of the century, and they were still trying to figure out their place in this society, and still some generations later still are. You know, I can, you know, look back and see my family, you know, place in this society. They were here at the inception. They were of this country and as it evolved. And so when I look at history, I can also look at where my family was at that time of in history, whether it's from the Revolutionary War to the Civil War, you know, to World War I, World War II, and the Korean War.
I would assume you've been still an avid reader, and I wonder if there are any specific authors that hold influence to you as you continue writing and reading in your adult life.
Well, actually, that was very important because, as I said earlier, I had no idea what to write about. And couldn't figure out a topic. And so then I stumbled on John Grisham. And, you know, his legal thrillers I found fascinating and captivating. And as a result, you know, being trained as a lawyer, it then gave me a subject to write about. It gave me an idea and ideas on topics to write about. And then I, you know, got very, very interested in John le Carré and his spy thrillers, his psychological thrillers. And so I then moved on from sort of a historical legal novel to spy novels. And that's what my current two novels, Blue Money and the current novel that I'm working on.
Do you find that you have, I'm going to use the term unfinished, but novels that are kind of started or concepts that are started that you then kind of exhaust out your current thought process and revisit at a different time when you feel like you're ready to start that next piece of that novel?
Oh yeah, I think every writer does. I think, you know, that has a lot to do with development as a writer. One would be the feeling that you're not sure if you're ready for this novel. Maybe the concept isn't as clear to you as what the novel is about. And that becomes a part of the process. I would say that I would not have been able to write Blue Money because that was a novel. I'd gone and lived in the Congo during the Great African War several years ago. And that novel wasn't ready to emerge until I was able to finish the other novels. And it wasn't a question of finishing the other novel, but developing the confidence and the ability to write about what I experienced. And also, there's a part of you that begins to filter and process those experiences and be able to put them in words and fictionalize them into ideas.
That brings up a great question of, within your writing, are there real life experiences that you find that make their way into the writing, or does it remind you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. For example, you know, when I was in the Congo during this period of time, you know, it was the Great African War. And I was introduced to a person who then another American who was a lawyer there, who then introduced me to an Angolan guy who worked for him over there. And then we met some other gentleman through him who took us, blindfolded us, and took us on a taxi ride outside of town to some little house, which they were actually dipping black paper, which they called black money, into a solution that would turn into American dollars. I was like, oh my God, what they wanted was for us to give them money to purchase the solution, because we were Americans and they figured, oh, Americans all have money. And I was like, I'm not interested. No, thanks. Because my thought was, yeah, we give them our money, then they just shoot us and they have our money and they go do what they're going to do, whatever it is. And sure. And I wasn't quite sure if it was real or not real, or you know, whether we could try, because, you know, there were so many things that go on over there that, you know, people are trying to trick you or do something to get, and it's always a way to try to get your money, to separate you from your money. That was actually American money. What I later learned was that this was the CIA who financed the Congolese takeover. Kabila financed the rebels who were taking over from Mobutu, the capital of Kinshasa. And that's where they were making money to purchase arms and guns and everything like that. And that is how it evolved. I then took that story and developed it in a way and turned it from that black money into blue money.
I just want to take a minute here to remind our listeners that you're tuned in to News Radio 1450 WILM and 1410 WDOV for Delaware State of the Arts. Greg, I'd love to turn it over to you, just as we've been talking about Blue Money here, to have you read an excerpt from that novel of yours. So,
okay, I'll read the very first section, and it starts out, Goma, Democratic Republic of the Congo. For a second, I had to think about how I found myself blindfolded in the backseat between two Kadogas holding Russian AK-47s like toys. As the Mercedes 500S sped across the African savannah, I questioned whether this was really a smart move on my part. Although the Benz's air conditioner was blasting, sweat streaked down my face in beads. Soon, we came to a stop. 6 days earlier, Sunday, Kinshasa, Democratic Republic of the Congo. My name is D'Angelo Cooper. Most people called me Coop or DC, and I'm a member of the U.S. Embassy stationed in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, formerly Zaire. It was my first deployment as part of the Special Ops Unit of the CIA assigned to the DRC. My cover, Act Like an African-American Tourist, Rediscovering My Roots in the Motherland. My job, mingle with locals and gather intel, the who, what, and where, on any strange behavior or activities. The why would be sorted out by another group of intelligence specialists. In other words, let someone else do the dirty work, the logistics. My contact in the Congolese army, General Femi, a brown-skinned Tutsi who gave off an engaging affect, but was a natural-born killer with dubious ambition. Behind dark Ray-Bans, General Femi sat at the corner table outside the Shea 1010 Cafe. His entourage of soldiers barricaded every angle. No one entered or left. Bonjour, General Femi. As I approached the cafe, Femi's entourage closed in, guns pointed. The general raised his hand, growled something in Swahili, and like trained Dobermans, the soldiers retreated. This brought a grin to Femi's face. He relished the power. Ah, Monsieur Coop, mon ami. Femi stood. I extended my hand. He grabbed me and pulled me into an embrace. You greet the Western way. In the DRC, we embrace friends like family and kiss like so. General Femi pressed his lips first against my left, then my right cheeks. Femi was tall, with a firm, authoritative grip. I'm 6'2", but Femi was still a good 7 inches taller than I am. Where I'm muscular and built, Femi was thin, very thin, like a piece of peanut brittle. I hate peanut brittle. It's deceptively dangerous, hard candy that can choke you or crack a tooth. Plus, I have a peanut allergy. This is how I thought of General Femi, a piece of hard candy that could cause my tongue to swell and choke me to death. Como va tu? He asked. Good, I answered. He held me arm's length, observed my physical frame, and smiled. You're looking as fit as a fiddle. The Congo has been good for you. I smiled and replied, Très bien. General Femi said excitingly, Ah, Monsieur Coop, speaking Francais now, I see. Could that have anything to do with that little Dada who escorts you everywhere? I smiled, but was surprised. Oui, Monsieur, we know everything, every move. Our intel is good. He laughed, slapping me on the back. But we keep secrets, too. General Femi wasn't someone I trusted with my secrets. Washington believed that if anyone was to lead a military junta, Femi would be the one. He looked the part, dressed in crisp military fatigues, his black boots, old-fashioned spit and shine, his .45 holstered to his right hip, where his hand usually rested. He had a quick smile that matched his desire to kill. Femi liked meeting in public places, so an outside cafe was not unusual. He liked being seen by the people on the streets. It was the fear. He liked seeing the fear in their faces when they saw him. In the streets, locals referred to Femi in Bantu as Mfuma ya Unzambi, chief of the dead. Monsieur, I've over 200 soldiers that would kill anyone to protect me. As General Femi grinned, the sun reflected off his dark Ray-Bans. His face had a deep white smile. Yes, General, I'm sure, but would one take a bullet for you given the chance? I don't know. Let's find out. You and you, come, he barked as two soldiers followed. Come, come, you come too, Monsieur Coop. I hesitated, concerned. Femi had a reputation for being an unpredictable wild man. We moved into the cafe's alley, the sun at our backs, casting a tall shadow, and waited. General Femi took out his gun and pointed it at a soldier's head. The soldier started to sweat. Femi grinned. Soldier, take out your gun and point it at me. The soldier slowly began to lift his gun. His eyes widened. I heard the sudden click, click of triggers cocked aimed at him. There was silence. No one said a word. The soldier's eyes narrowed as he cocked his trigger. Go on, shoot me, soldier. Are you ready to die for me? Femi yelled. The soldier flinched. The others didn't. I wanted to shout, stop, but I was silent as well. Then came the rat-tat-tat-tat of rapid fire. When the smoke cleared, the soldier lay sprawled on the ground, blood seeping from his body, forming puddles. You, take him out of here, Femi ordered a soldier. General Femi, I started to protest. Femi held his hand up. There's a code of machismo amongst Congolese military. He violated the code. I didn't understand and wanted to ask what he meant. After the soldiers took over Kinshasa, many became bored from nothing to do, and noise set in, their antics getting drunk and randomly shooting AK-47s off derived from boredom. General Femi's behavior didn't help. He began a geopolitical analysis of the First and Second Congo Wars. Washington was concerned over the DRC's newly formed government, I said. Yes, since the U.S. financed us. The blue money, I know. The CIA financed the rebels. After Mobutu fled, I explained, the whereabouts of the blue money was unknown. My job was to do reconnaissance and locate it. So you want me to help you locate it? General Femi smiled. Well, yes. Femi's grin was broad and more conspiratorial. If I'm able to locate it and say point you in the right direction, is there a finder's fee?
Thank you, Gregory, for sharing that reading from Blue Money. If you'd like to hear more from his novel, you can attend a free public reading at the Brandywine Public Library at 1300 Folk Road in Wilmington, Delaware, on October 22nd from 1 to 3 p.m. Delaware State of the Arts is provided as a service of the Delaware Division of the Arts in partnership with News Radio 1450 WILM and 1410 WDOV. The Delaware Division of the Arts, a branch of the Delaware Department of State, is committed to supporting the arts and cultivating creativity to enhance the quality of life in Delaware. Together with its advisory body, the Delaware State Arts Council, the division administers grants and programs that support arts programming, educate the public, increase awareness of the arts, and integrate the arts into all facets of Delaware life. To find out more about the division, visit arts.delaware.gov.